Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1177, the Jakarta Method in Latin America. This is being recorded on March 24th of the year 2021. The charges being bandied about against China for a supposed, quote, genocide, unquote, against the Muslim Turkophone Uyghur minority in Xinjiang province have escalated, with sanctions being leveled by the UK, the EU, Canada, and the US against Chinese officials. We talked about the manipulation of the Uyghurs and the destabilization of China. And in our last program, we pointed out that the exemptions accorded to the Uyghurs from Chinese limitations on the number of children permitted per family, that is two for urban residents and three for rural residents, that exemption was eliminated, and whereas the Uyghurs were permitted to have as many as 10 children in some cases, now they must conform to the limitations on offspring that have been accorded to Han Chinese as well. This has led to a decrease in the population of Uyghurs in Xinjiang province relative to the rest of the Chinese population. But as an analyst with the Naval War College pointed out in an article that we covered in our last program, to call the Chinese treatment of the Uyghurs, quote, genocide, unquote, is simply ludicrous. It is insulting to, among others, families who have had relatives who died in the Holocaust. In the recent, well, not just recently, but another story that has gained publicity over a number of years and is accelerating again, and that is the crush of Central American refugees looking to enter the U.S. One of the factors in that is the orgiastic violence that was perpetrated against residents of those countries in recent years, and in no small measure with the collaboration of or even at the instigation of the U.S., calling, arresting some of them and sending them back might be compared with burning down someone's house and then calling the police when they run across your front lawn to get away from the burning home. I think in order to provide perspective on both the, quote, genocide, unquote, that is being, quote, perpetrated, unquote, against the Uyghurs, and also for some historical perspective on one of the major factors that has led people in Latin America, Central America in particular, to leave their homeland in hopes of gaining entry into the U.S., and that is the extermination programs that have been implemented in those countries. I'm going to be relying for information in this program and perhaps for our next program as well. We'll see how things work out time-wise on a very important recent book called The Jakarta Method. That's J-A-K-A-R-T-A, the capital of Indonesia. It is authored by Vincent Bevins, B-E-V-I-N-S, and subtitled Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program that Shaped Our World. Anti-Communist here perhaps should be in quotes. This book was published in hardcover by Public Affairs Books. That is an imprint of Hatchet, H-A-T-C-H-E-T-T-E. And this is an excellent book. There are some things in it that might appear somewhat skewed to veteran listeners and readers, but this is an excellent book, a very important book, and I recommend it enthusiastically. There was even an op-ed column in the Sunday New York Times some time ago by Vincent Bevins. It was unusual to see this subject matter discussed in the New York Times op-ed piece. But the book itself, again, is excellent. The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade, and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World by Vincent Bevins. I can't recommend this book strongly enough. And again, as always, this is presented for fair use. I don't get any money whatsoever from the author, the publisher, the book, or this program, or the written descriptions for this program. The title, The Jakarta Method, refers to the CIA-implemented coup in Jakarta that ultimately resulted in roughly a million people being killed, and the virtual genocide against the native Chinese population. There is a large Chinese ethnic population, or was, in Indonesia, and many of them were exterminated. There were up to a million people killed. Furthermore, the methodology in that 1965 Indonesia coup served as something of a template for subsequent CIA extermination and CIA assisted extermination programs in the third world countries. It also dovetailed closely with a program in Brazil following the 1964 coup there, and ultimately, as the military crackdown in Brazil accentuated, the Jakarta Method, as it was called, was implemented in Brazil and Chile and other places in Latin America in the 1970s and 1980s. The warning that Jakarta is coming, or simply Jakarta, often in Spanish or Portuguese, became a terror, a watchword of terror for some of the, well, not just left-leaning activists, but union activists, Jews, and many other people as well. We've spoken about some of the things that we are going to talk about in this program in numerous other broadcasts. We are going to talk about Operation Condor, the dirty war in Argentina. Operation Condor was a CIA-assisted international assassination consortium that brought together a number of different Latin American countries to help with the extermination of each other's political dissidents. And there was active international cooperation with those. Operation Condor, again, was assisted generously by the CIA and had as one of its operational epicenters a Colonia Dignidad in Chile, a Nazi enclave in Chile that had been a haven for Nazi war criminals of the Dispina Odessa networks. We have spoken about this subject material, this part of it, in numerous programs, including AFA program number 4, number 19, and number 22, among other broadcasts. We've also spoken about this in some of our discussions with Peter Lavenda, the author of the book The Hitler Legacy. Peter Lavenda, in For the Record 839, related a harrowing account of his visit to Colonia Dignidad, a visit that he fortunately escaped with his life. And so, to give us some perspective on what this country has done abroad, and something that will give us perspective on the quote genocide unquote propaganda being bandied about, echoed too, by the way, by Joe Biden and Anthony Blinken, our Secretary of State, or Biden's Secretary of State. I think it would be useful to relate this information. And again, the book's title, The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World, authored by Vincent Bevins, B-E-V-I-N-S. And this book gets the 5-star Dave Emery rating. I can't recommend it enthusiastically enough. And again, I get no money whatsoever from the program, the written description, the book, the author, or the publisher. This is for fair use. Now, we're going to begin with a look at the extermination program in Argentina during the Dirty War in the 1970s. I would note in passing that this was an operation part of the operations of what author Henrik Kruger of The Great Heroin Coup called the Internacional Fascista, or Fascist International. Some of the people discussed here, such as José López Rega and Admiral Emilio Massera, were members of the Argentine branch of the Propaganda Due Lodge, as discussed in AFA program number 19. And the extermination program in Argentina, Operation Condor, the assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C., subjects, again, that we have discussed at great length in other programs, are presented here. By the way, there is a reference to the stay-behind armies created by Frank Wisner. The stay-behind armies in Italy were called Operation Gladio, and in Germany they used many members of the young Nazis under Adolf Hitler, including members of the Werewolf organization. We have spoken about that in a number of programs. We've spoken about Operation Gladio in numerous For the Record shows. There will be references in the written description for the program, and we talk about the Stay Behind program in Germany in one of our treatments of the book The Devil's Chessboard about Alan Dulles, that by Frank Talbot. David Talbot, excuse me. Of the Dirty War in Argentina, part of the Jakarta Method in Latin America, Vincent Bevins writes as follows. In 1976, a coup in Argentina brought to power the bloodiest of these regimes. Actually, let me start a little bit earlier. Brazil started to slide little by little away from its more hardline anti-communist neighbors. Meanwhile, Chile's Operation Condor continued to expand its activities all around Latin America until the continent was a veritable anti-communist killing zone. Thereafter, any real threat to U.S.-aligned authoritarian capitalist development existed mostly in the paranoid minds of the Condor Alliance dictators and their U.S. allies. The fanatical anti-communists won the continent, as we're about to see. The term anti-communist or subversive really belongs in quotes. They are tarring with a very broad brush, not just peaceful, non-violent anti-communists, but basically just about anybody they didn't like. Continuing now with Vincent Bevins' account in the Jakarta Method. In 1976, a coup in Argentina brought to power the bloodiest of these regimes. Under General Jorge Rafael Videla, V-I-D-E-L-A, the dictatorship kidnapped, tortured, and disappeared tens of thousands of people. Videla's regime cast a much wider net than Pinochet's men did in Chile. This period is often called, somewhat incorrectly, the Dirty War, unquote, but there was no war. It was a top-down, quote, anti-communist, unquote, extermination campaign with ideological roots in Argentina's homegrown fascist movement. Quote, subversives, unquote, were tortured and killed for their real or perceived communism, for their real or perceived atheism, for their real or perceived Jewishness, or just for union activities. Ford Motor Company and Citibank collaborated with the disappearance of union, one more time, Ford Motor Company and Citibank collaborated with the disappearance of union workers. Even Beards were suspect. That's why a Brazilian piano player named Pinorinho, P-E-N-O-R-I-N-H-O, was brought in, thrown on a parrilla or grill for torture in Buenos Aires, and then drowned. Representatives from Argentina's military had already been at the meeting that launched Operation Condor in 1975, and the murderous AAA Alliance, the Alianza Anticomunista Argentina, had begun unleashing terror under Isabel Martinez de Perón, who served as president from 1974 to 1976. But the true believers were now in power. Admiral Emilio Massera declared Argentina was fighting a, quote, third world war, unquote, between dialectic materialism and idealistic humanism, unquote. This meant removing the influence of Marx as well as Freud and Albert Einstein. General Antonio Domingo explained how this worked. Quote, first, we will kill all subversives. Then, we will kill all of their collaborators. Then, we will kill those who sympathize with subversives. Then, we will kill those that remain indifferent. And finally, we will kill the timid, unquote. But the Condor Alliance didn't limit their activities to their own continent. They built upon the stay-behind armies Frank Wisner had helped to build in Europe to pursue their enemies in Germany, Spain, Italy, and Ireland. The men behind Operation Condor often considered the nonviolent democracy and human rights activists operating abroad to be even more dangerous than armed guerrillas at home. Most infamously, this logic led U.S. citizen, known CIA contact, and Condor operative Michael Vernon Townley to murder former Chilean Foreign Minister Orlando Letelier in the heart of Washington, D.C. A car bomb placed on Embassy Row blew Letelier's legs off, killing him instantly. His 25-year-old American assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, staggered from the car and slowly drowned in her own blood. Townley is now in FBI witness protection. And again, we spoke about Letelier, Vernon Townley, Columbia Dignan Pod, and Operation Condor, and among other programs, For the Record 839. Listen to Peter Lavenda's account in that program of his actual visit to Columbia Dignan Pod and see just what exactly the terror involved here entailed at an eyeball-to-eyeball level. And what we're going to look at next is the terror programs in Central America. We went into this as well in numerous programs, in particular AFA program number 15, the second of two AFA shows dealing with the former World Anti-Communist League, goes into the genesis of the Latin America, the Central American death squads, the White Hand or La Mano Blanca, at considerable length. And not surprisingly, death squads have a German Nazi and a global fascist genesis. The next section of Vincent Bevan's The Jakarta Method is titled Drain the Sea. That is a reference to a statement by Efrain Rios Montt, who came to power in Guatemala in a 1982 military coup, that the, quote, guerrillas, unquote, or the guerrilla is the fish. If you can't, the guerrilla is the fish and the people are the sea. If you can't catch the fish, drain the sea. And we'll see what that involved in just a minute. The countries of Central America are far more united than the nations of South America. Its peoples know one another well, and they tend to experience the ways of history in a similar fashion. This is especially true of the four most populous countries in the middle, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Honduras. Belize, at the very top, was a British colony, and down at the bottom, Panama took a very different historical path after the U.S. created the nation in order to build a canal. And by the way, parenthetically, as we've seen in a number of programs, Sullivan and Cromwell was front and center in that gambit. Continuing. And world history had crashed over their little subcontinent with punishing violence over the past few centuries. In the late 1970s and 1980s, this process rose to astonishing levels of brutality. Before this new storm of blood and screens even started, brutal oppression was already the rule for the vast majority of the population. The region was ruled by dictators who rarely bothered to hide their cruelty. The practice of, quote, forced labor, unquote, that is, the actual enslavement of the indigenous peoples that had started centuries prior, was still widespread. In Guatemala, the terror that started with the CIA coup against Jacobo Arbenz in 1954 and accelerated in 1965 after the arrival of John Gordon Mine, M-E-I-N, and John P. Longan, L-O-N-G-A-N, had never stopped. The year those two men arrived, 1965, El Salvador, Costa Rica, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, and Panama came together to formalize military links and intelligence sharing within El Consejo de Defensa Centroamericana, or CONDECA, C-O-N-D-E-C-A, all in caps, a kind of proto-alliance to put down the guerrilla threat. That threat was real. Mine himself was killed in 1968 by the FAR, the first rebel group formed in Guatemala in the wake of the 1960 clash over the CIA's use of a Guatemalan base to train Cuban exiles for the Bay of Pigs invasion. The violence unleashed by the Guatemalan dictatorship during the civil war that followed was indiscriminate. Right-wing terror groups like the Mano Blanca, the White Hand, the new anti-communist organization, and the Anti-Communist Council of Guatemala started their own massacres with the support of the U.S. Green Beret, and these death squads were eventually incorporated into the state. The disappearances that started in 1966 had expanded by the 1970s to transform Guatemala's cities into hunting grounds for any kind of perceived leftist or subversive. The number of people desaparecido by the state rose into the tens of thousands. If you were a union member, a student activist, a left-leaning politician, a critical journalist, or even a homeless child, you knew that the regime might come for you. As tension periodically rose around you, friends disappeared forever. You escalated evasive tactics, then settled back into your, quote, normal, unquote, life of low-level terror if you survived this time. Life was a permanent cat-and-mouse game, and Guatemala City became a deadly, sprawling obstacle course, sometimes for the entire lifespan of its victims. Miguel Angel Abizures, A-L-B-I-Z-U-R-E-S, the same little schoolboy who never forgot the trauma of the Sulfatos bombs dropped near his school during the U.S.-backed coup in 1954 against Arbenz, grew into a union organizer. The unions were not uniformly left-wing. As a teen, not long after the overthrow of Arbenz, he joined the Catholic Christian Workers Movement, and by the 1970s, he was a bit of a small-time leader. The union movement had moderate communists and Christian Democrats, as well as some who supported the more radical guerrillas. The government did not care much for these distinctions. In 1977, they busted open the door of a union meeting Miguel was attending, firing their guns. Miguel fled onto the roof and jumped from building to building to escape. Another time, they shot down several of his colleagues in front of the Coca-Cola factory. He knew he was lucky in a way because they apparently did not want to simply kill him. They easily could have done that in the street with some men in the car with machine guns. They wanted to capture, torture, and disappear him, hopefully getting some information along the way and creating mystery around his death. Since that was a little harder to pull off, he kept bobbing and weaving until he found a way out of the country. Quote, "We could never sleep in the same place for too long. We didn't see our families. It was constant suspicion, unending fear. We didn't know what was going on, but we knew that bodies were appearing everywhere around us, so we knew enough." By 1978, things were changing for Central America. In Nicaragua, a left-wing guerrilla group inspired by the Cuban Revolution, the Sandinistas, was poised to win power. In El Salvador, the government responded to protests against an obviously rigged election with a massacre. Hundreds were killed. Then a coup there led to a civil military regime, which also devolved into murderous repression, leading the civilians to quit, and support grew for leftist guerrillas. All of this made Guatemala's government nervous about its own survival. At home, new guerrilla groups were picking over for the older MR-13 and FAR, which had been crushed by the U.S.-backed insurgency campaign. The most prominent new group was the Ejército Guerrero de los Pobres, or EGP, or the Guerrilla Army of the Poor. Unlike the FAR, which followed Che Guevara's FOCO, or Focus, strategy for organizing small guerrilla units, the EGP sought to enlist the larger rural population in the guerrilla struggle, emulating the victorious Viet Cong. The Guatemalan government began to kill indigenous people en masse simply because of their ethnic background. Entire ethnicities, whole tribes, complete villages were marked as either communist or likely to become communist. They were often people who had only a vague idea of what Marxism or the guerrilla groups actually were. This was a new, beginning again, this was new, different from the urban terror tactics in which the government forces kidnap individual people. For the Mayans and other indigenous groups, the army would come and simply kill every single one of them. The close collaboration of U.S. officials with Central American dictatorships as they slaughtered their own populations is well documented, far better than U.S. activities in Indonesia leading up to the coup of October 1965. The scale of the violence, however, and the consequences of the actions are often underestimated. Miguel Angel Albizures, A-L-B-I-Z-U-R-E-S again, and others who lived through the late 1970s and 1980s in Central America always stress that these new Central American guerrilla movements emerged only after attempts at peaceful transition to democracy were brutally suppressed or indeed exterminated. They say that almost every political ideology in the world, not just the socialism and Marxism dominant in those guerrilla groups, allows for armed resistance against tyrants, and that includes the U.S. revolutionary tradition itself. Nor is it surprising that the surviving movements were left-wing militants. By the late 1970s, most of the moderate dissidents were dead. And then Vincent Bevins talks about Jimmy Carter actually tamping down U.S. support for some of these Central American regimes. That was among the many factors that led to his destabilization via the so-called October Surprise that we talked about in among other shows. For the records, 896, 97, 98, and 99. Skipping down and continuing. In Central America, however, Jimmy Carter's government tapped the brakes a bit on brutal realpolitik. In this era, after both Watergate and the 1975 Church Committee investigations into the CIA and FBI, the U.S. media were less reflexively uncritical of Washington's covert and overt Cold War schemes abroad. Outlets such as the New York Times and Washington Post played crucial roles in publicizing the massacres at Panzos, Guatemala, the village where the military was caught gunning down men, women, and children in 1978. Washington banned the sale of weapons to regimes that did not meet basic human rights criteria. Rather than even try, the Guatemalan dictatorship, now run by a man named Fernando Romeo Lucas Garcia, turned to Israel and Taiwan, which stepped in to supply the weapons and assistance instead of the U.S. U.S.-Guatemala collaboration continued at a number of levels, but Carter's position was enough to enrage some of the most committed anti-communists in the hemisphere. Mario Sandoval Alarcón, one of the founders of La Mano Blanca, and now vice president, accused the Carter administration's Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of being, quote, a Marxist instrument that has caused, Mario Sandoval Alarcón, one of the founders of La Mano Blanca, the White Hand, and now vice president of Guatemala, accused the Carter administration's Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of being, quote, a Marxist instrument that has used the cause of human rights as a tool for slander, unquote. In July of 1979, the Sandinistas took Managua and set up a government in Nicaragua. For leftists across Central America, this was a moment of effervescence just as 1970 had been for Chilean socialists. The Sandinistas had not only won, they had gotten away with it. Even the British punk band The Clash, over in England, sang ecstatically about the shocking developments. For the very first time ever, when they had a revolution in Nicaragua, there was no interference from America. Human rights in America. The people fought the Lieber, and up he flew. With no Washington bullets, what else could he do? That again, from lyrics by the British punk band The Clash. In its early days, the Communist Party in Nicaragua had opposed the Sandinistas' emphasis on armed struggle. Over the years, The Front Sandinista de Liberación Nacional, or FSLN, split into three factions. The group that won out, the relatively moderate third faction known as the Tercelistas, T-E-R-C-E-R-I-S-T-A-S, favored a broad tactical alliance with the bourgeoisie. It was this group, led by Daniel and Humberto Ortega, that took power as the dominant part of a coalition government. The Tercelistas would stand in democratic elections. Like Ho Chi Minh, Mao, Arbenz, Fidel, Sukarno, and Allende before them, the Tercelistas initially hoped to set up a government that Washington could tolerate. Infamously, these hopes would be dashed when Ronald Reagan took over and began funding the Contra rebels. But the leaders of Operation Condor did not wait for a go-ahead from Reagan to handle the leftist government taking root in Central America. In 1977, convinced that Carter had abandoned them in their, quote, holy war, unquote, against communism, Argentine officials began providing military training to the Somoza regime in Nicaragua. After the 1979 Sandinista victory, they set up a base in Honduras to teach Guatemalans and Nicaraguans the arts of counter-revolution and repression. Central American soldiers went to Chile for training in anti-communist counter-insurgency tactics. The 1980 meeting of the Latin chapter of the World Anti-Communist League, held in Buenos Aires, enabled death squad leaders to form even closer ties with South American governments, as well as U.S. Republican congressmen. The methods that were used in Central America in the following years reflected the defining features of Operation Condor. Targeted abductions and murders by multinational hunter-killer squadrons, often made up of Contras and Honduran commandos in civilian clothes. Clandestine transfers of prisoners across borders, methods like disappearance, torture, and assassination of victims, including the use of electric shock, the capucha, or asphyxiation, and the throwing of live people from helicopters, interrogations of prisoners by officers from several countries, and detention centers for foreign disappeared prisoners. When Reagan took over, Washington returned to more open and aggressive anti-communist tactics than had been seen in two decades. The CIA eagerly joined the Argentines in Honduras and, in the biggest agency operation since the Bay of Pigs, began training and funding the Contra rebels. The Contras were not a regular army and never seriously tried to beat the Sandinistas in a direct confrontation. They were a well-funded terrorist group seeking to destabilize the regime however they could. And their worldview and tactics were radically transformed by the fanatical anti-communism of their sponsors. The former public relations chief of the Contras, Edgar Chamorro, made clear that the powerful ideological influence of the Argentine officers and CIA operations reshaped their movement. Historian Patrice McSherry writes that, quote, "The anti-Sandinistas were originally concerned with retaining their private property and oligarchical power and privilege, or pursuing revenge. But the messianic anti-communist ideology of the Argentines and the Americans began to reshape their rationale for the war," unquote. They also learned lessons from abroad. A CIA officer going by John Kirkpatrick, with counterinsurgency experience in the Phoenix program in Vietnam, compiled a training course that included an assassination manual for the Contras. One section was titled "Implicit and Explicit Terror," unquote. According to Argentine journalists Juan Pablo Sipka, C-S-I-P-K-A, and Ignacio González Janzen, J-A-N-Z-E-N, the Argentines and the Central Americans have also discussed employing the Jakarta method. They report that in the early 1970s, before the country had fallen to the brutal Videla dictatorship, the leader of Argentina's far-right AAA death squad, a politician named José López Rega, was in Franco's Spain. There, he met with Máximo Zapata, the leader of Guatemala's new anti-communist organization, Death Squad. They spoke of the plan Jakarta, unquote, and what it entailed. A, quote, prophylactic coup, unquote, that will allow them to defeat the Marxists by, quote, virtually exterminating them after conservatives took power. These Argentine authors claimed the meeting was arranged by the U.S. ambassador to Spain, Robert Hill, and that frequent CIA collaborator Zapata not only handed over some Plan Jakarta reports he held, but told his anti-communist comrade that Washington would assist him in forming shock troops to put the plan into action in Argentina. Quote, "We won't need to kill a million like in Indonesia," José López Rega reported, "because we can get it done with 10,000, unquote. He guessed low. Anti-communists killed far more than that in Argentina. On March 24th, 1980, Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero began to say Mass in San Salvador, the capital of El Salvador. Romero had recently spoken out against the wanton human rights abuses committed by the government. After he finished his sermon that night, a man burst into the church and murdered him. The assassination was carried out by a death squad led by Major Roberto D'Abuisson, a fanatical anti-communist who had trained at the School of the Americas in 1972. Whereas Fort Leavenworth is an all-purpose military academy for students from all over the world, the School of the Americas, based in the U.S.-controlled Panama Canal Zone, unquote, was a training ground for Latin American counterinsurgents, unquote. The school became so notorious that Panama expelled it from its territory, and the school changed its name in 2000 to the, quote, Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation, unquote. D'Abuisson also attended the Political Warfare Cadres Academy in Taiwan, which by then had provided training to officials from almost every Latin American nation. In 1983, D'Abuisson, nicknamed Blowtorch Bob for his practice of torturing prisoners with a blowtorch, summed up the actually existing anti-communist ideology very well. Quote, "You can be a communist," he told reporter Laurie Beckland, "even if you personally don't believe you are a communist," unquote. When the Salvadorian Civil War got underway, the military, backed by Ronald Reagan, made scorched earth tactics a routine part of its modus operandi. On December 11th, 1981, reports surfaced of a massacre at El Mozote village. Salvadorian troops executed more than 900 men, women, and children with U.S.-made assault rifles. The next day, Reagan appointed a Harvard-trained former liberal named Elliot Abrams to serve as Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights and Humanitarian Affairs. Put simply, his job was to defend U.S.-allied right-wing regimes to the press and shield them from criticism coming from appalled human rights groups. Abrams called the accounts of the slaughter in El Mozote, including those published in the New York Times, quote, "communist propaganda," unquote. This is still the most famous atrocity of the Salvadorian Civil War, but it was only a tiny fraction of the violence unleashed on civilians. For years and years, the savagery dragged on and only deepened because Washington refused to allow the right-wing government to negotiate a political solution with the rebels. Since the rebels had links to, quote, communists, unquote, in Nicaragua, no negotiation was possible, according to Ronald Reagan's logic. But it was in Guatemala, Central America's biggest country, and the site of the CIA's first major, quote, victory, unquote, in the hemisphere back in 1954, that normal people faced the largest bloodbath But it was in Guatemala, Central America's biggest country and the site of the CIA's first major victory in the hemisphere back in 1954, that normal people faced the largest bloodbath unleashed by the Cold War in the Western Hemisphere. The small community of Ilom, I-L-O-M, is nestled between misty mountains in northwest Guatemala, close to the Mexican border. One more time. The small community of Ilom is nestled between misty mountains in northwest Guatemala, closer to the Mexican border than to the Guatemalan capital. The people are Mayan and speak Ixil, capital I-X-I-L, not Spanish, and for decades they have been either subsistence farming or working for pennies on a nearby ranch. That ranch was owned by rich white men and sat on the land taken from the Mayans centuries ago, and over the years, that ranch kept getting bigger and bigger. Ilom is too far from Guatemala City to have been affected by Jacobo Arbenz's incipient land reform program in 1954. Residents barely heard about the reforms that were snuffed out by the CIA. In 1981, however, global politics arrived in the village. First, the EGP, the Ejército Guerrero de los Pobres, came to visit. Speaking Spanish, the guerrillas explained that they were on the Mayans' side, that they were building a revolution that would help them get their land back, and they were fighting for them. Josefa Sanchez de Barrio, B-A-R-R-I-O, who was 16 at the time, remembers that most of the villagers were politely receptive to this message, if a bit puzzled about the specifics. Few of them spoke Spanish. It wasn't quite clear what these 30 to 40 revolutionaries in green fatigues planned to do, or how the villagers were supposed to help them. But the villagers thanked them, gave them the customary hospitality of thick corn tortillas and some kind words, and then waved goodbye. Not long after, the army sent in men pretending to be guerrillas. It didn't take long for the villagers to figure out what was going on. The men's costumes were shabby, one even wore a cheap, fake beard. And they were acting all wrong, asking too many questions, and treating the villagers aggressively. The guerrillas hadn't acted that way at all when they came. This was not a sophisticated undercover operation. There were clearly just some young military men trying to figure out who was most sympathetic to the rebels. In January of 1982, the military men came back. This time, they were in their army uniforms, but with black paint on their faces. They burst into Josefa's home. It didn't surprise her that her family was on their list. Her father had been part of a small group that tried back in the 1970s to ask the local government down in the nearest city to save their land. They dragged away her husband's father. They smashed Josefa in the head with a rock, then several men shoved a napkin into her mouth and raped her. All in all, 30 people were taken that day, never to return. A few days later, the soldiers came back and took Josefa's father and brother. In February, the soldiers came again. Josephus' own brother was working in the field, and they lobbed a grenade at him and killed him. They took more people away that day, and this time they burned down the empty homes as they left. Antonio Cabacaba, C-A-B-A, C-A-B-A, a young boy, realized something was wrong that day when he came back from working in the fields. As he approached his home, he saw his mother standing in the doorway wearing the long red skirt worn by Mayan women in the region, staring blankly into the distance. "What's wrong?" he asked her. She told him about the fires. The soldiers had burned an old woman alive in her home as they left. Some people began to discuss running, but there was nowhere to go except into the mountains, where they'd soon run out of food. This was the worst violence their community had ever experienced. They came to the conclusion that finally it must be over. They were wrong. On March 23rd, the soldiers came back at 5 in the morning and woke up every single person in Ilon. They were wearing the black paint again. Quote, "Come on, there is a town meeting. You are going," they told Antonio and Josefa and everyone else. They walked the villages to the tiny town square. They sent the men into the little church behind the plaza and the women into the tiny courthouse next door. Antonio heard one of them fidgeting on the radio, talking to a superior. Quote, "We're going to kill the guerrillas," he said. One by one, then two by two, they brought men out of the church, stood them in front of the schoolhouse, and shot them. Everyone could see each murder. That was clearly the point. After about 100 were dead, they stopped. "We're only killing the ones that look guilty, the ones that look afraid," unquote, one of the soldiers said. Other villages weren't so lucky. In many parts of this region, the military simply killed every man, woman, and child. The government had decided that the Ixil were intrinsically communist, or at least very likely to become communist. In Indonesia, it may not have been the case that the mass murder was genocide. It was simply anti-communist mass murder. In Guatemala, it was anti-communist genocide. By the way, Amnesty International put the death toll at roughly 400,000 and called it genocide against the Mayans. On March 23, 1982, General Efrain Rios Montt took power in Guatemala in a military coup. He was an evangelical Christian, which made him a special favorite of Ronald Reagan, and he continued the genocide in a slightly different fashion. Some indigenous people from ethnically suspect communities were herded into state-built aldeas modelos, or model villages, built to help indigenous people start new lives in suitably non-communist fashion, which often amounted to little more than deadly concentration camps. For many others, massacres simply continued apace. As was the case of Indonesia and Brazil and Argentina, Mont's religious zeal gave the anti-communist violence a theological justification. Quote, "They are communists, and therefore atheists, and therefore they are demons, and therefore you can kill them," unquote, is how one Civil War victim, now the head of one of Guatemala's most prominent research organizations, summarizes the logic. The vast majority of the murdered were practitioners of traditional Mayan religions. The remaining residents of Ilan were forced into slavery, but this time they had to work for the military. Antonio was forced to join a militia and grew up, quote, fighting, unquote, the guerrillas for the rest of the 1980s. They rebelled quietly by intentionally missing when shooting at the, quote, enemy, unquote. Josefa, quickly married, if she had not, she would have been forced to, quote, marry, unquote, one of the soldiers watching over the Aldea Modelo, forced into sexual slavery like so many of her friends. Their village was liquidated and burned to the ground. This was all part of Rios Montt's new strategy for fighting communism. Quote, "The gorilla is the fish, the people are the sea," he said. "If you cannot catch the fish, you have to drain the sea," unquote. From 1978 to 1983, the Guatemalan military killed more than 200,000 people. Again, Amnesty International puts it more like 400,000. Around a third of these were taken away and disappeared, unquote, largely in urban areas. Most of the rest were indigenous Mayans massacred in the open air of the fields and mountains where their families had lived for generations. The Salvadorian Civil War took 75,000 lives. Again, the majority were innocent people killed by the government. Argentina killed 20,000 to 30,000 civilians, and other Operation Condor nations killed tens of thousands more. Anti-communist extermination had spread all across Latin America, always with the assistance of the United States. Taken together, the death toll approaches the estimated size of the 1965-1966 massacres in Indonesia. And later on, in the end of this book, again, the title of the book, The Jakarta Method, Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World, by Vincent Bevins. Vincent Bevins goes to various cities and interviews some of the survivors of these programs. And in Guatemala City, when I spoke with experts like Clara Arenas, head of the Asociación para el Avance de las Ciencias Sociales en Guatemala, we used slightly different terminology. Was the relationship that the U.S. had to Guatemala in 1954 imperialist, I asked? An easy one. Yes, unquote. Is the relationship between Washington, the government now, and Guatemala still imperialist? Still easy? Still yes. On the bus from the town of Ilon to Nabaj, people had a slightly different understanding of 20th century politics. There was a different way of speaking employed by the Ixil people, most of whom still speak broken or accented Spanish. I asked them what they thought communism was. Domingo, the owner of the school bus, had this answer, quote, "Well, they said they were communists and that communists are dangerous. But actually, the government are the ones who did all the killing, so if anyone was dangerous, if anyone was, quote, communist, unquote, it must be them," unquote. An interesting spin on these events. Again, we have been reading from the book, as I said, The Jakarta Method, by Vincent Bevins, subtitled Washington's Anti-Communist Crusade and the Mass Murder Program That Shaped Our World, published in hardcover by the Public Access Press, which is an imprint of Hatchet Books. This book gets the 5-star rating from Dave Emery. And again, I get no money whatsoever from this. This concludes For the Record program number 1177, The Jakarta Method in Latin America, being recorded on March 24th of the year 2021. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.